Welcome to the Behind the Show podcast. My name is James Gearing, and this is episode 167. And I am delighted to bring to you this week Air Force pararescueman Jason Sweet. Now, on top of his career in the Air Force, Jason has also played college football for the University of Arizona and helps mentor future candidates for police, fire, military with his company, SOCOM Athlete. So in this conversation, we explore trauma medicine. We talk about setting the bar high, expectations, physical demands, mental resilience, and a host of other topics. So you're going to really glean a lot from this conversation. As I always say before we start the interview, please go to your podcast app, rate the show, subscribe, of course, and then most importantly, use social media and share the hell out of these episodes that we have. Every single person that I have on each week has valuable information that I know needs to reach the ear holes of everyone in these professions that we're associated with. So please help me grow this project and please help me spread the knowledge of these incredible people that we have. So with that being said, I introduce to you Jason Sweet. Enjoy. I just want to start by saying thank you so much, Jason, for agreeing to come on the podcast. Like several people now, we have this kind of back and forth via social media, which people demonize as being a very toxic environment, but I found so many great people through there as well. But so firstly, welcome to the show.
Thank you, James.
All right.
Thank you.
Where are we? Thank you. So where are we finding you today?
I'm in Tucson, Arizona.
Tucson. So my very first question, were you born in Arizona?
No, sir. I was actually born in the panhandle of Florida. My father was stationed at Eglin Air Force Base. He was a PJ there, and I was born in Valparaiso Hospital.
Brilliant. All right. So your dad was a PJ. What about your mom, and how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have one brother. He's 4 years younger than me, and my mom was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Okay. And did she have a career as well? Was she a housewife?
So my mom was a horse whisperer, and she still is. Breaks horses. People would bring her horses that were bucking and sometimes even trying to turn over backwards and smash their owner because they were abused and had some type of problem. And she was one of the only people who would be able to train the horse. So she did that for a time as somewhat of a pastime. She got her master's in horse therapy. She's a real cowgirl.
Fantastic. All right. And then what about your early years? Were you an athlete even when you were young?
I was. I started playing baseball at a young age. My father tried to expose me to a lot of different sports. Got me into karate when I was 5. I thought that was good. It taught me some discipline. Tried soccer out. Wasn't a big fan. Even played football while I was young, but I ended up getting ran over quite a bit. So I stuck with baseball in my younger years.
Right. And then what about your career aspirations in school age? What were you hoping to be when you graduated?
I wanted to be a pro baseball player.
All right. So then you had an injury that kind of stifled that career. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it an injury. I feel that as a pitcher, God gives you a genetic throw count. And when you hit that number, your arm just stops working. I don't see too many 60-year-old pitchers out there still humming a 65-mile-an-hour fastball, much less any 60-year-old pitchers. I think one of the oldest guys I can remember really dominating on the mound was Curt Schilling. But unfortunately for me, at 19 years old, my fastball went from 90, 91 miles an hour to about 80, 81, and I wasn't effective as a pitcher. And that was while on scholarship at Grand Canyon University. So at that point, my arm didn't really work anymore, and we call it dead arm in the community as a pitcher.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, what's the physiology behind that?
Well, I couldn't really tell you the physiology just besides wear and tear. But when I did get an MRI, I had some tendonitis and I had a deformed humeral head and I had some mobility that had just never really come back. And he said I just had kind of lost my pop in the arm. So I tried some cortisone shots and some things like that, experimented with different arm slots, tried less long toss, doing different drills and whatnot. A lot of different experiments didn't really work out. So I just wore it out.
Right. Now, leading up to that, you said your dad was a PJ. Had he tried to inspire you to become a PJ or join the military, or had he done the polar opposite and tried to push you away?
He definitely didn't try to push me away. I would say that if anything, he tried to get me to follow my dreams and expose me to anything and everything he could.
Okay, so then after the results with the arm, what drove you then to start looking at the military as a career?
Well, that was a long process, but not being able to play baseball anymore was one of it. And I originally wanted to be a SEAL. And I started the process of talking to a Navy recruiter. And my father had always told me stories of being a PJ, but I guess it had just never been as glamorous and as public as being a SEAL. So generally, whenever you think about going into special operations as a kid, that's one of the first things that crossed your mind. So once my father had really kind of exposed that to me, I had known a little bit more about pararescue, but it was actually a pretty incredible setting whenever I found out that I wanted to go into pararescue, and pararescue was my path. I had, like I said, been playing baseball at Grand Canyon, and it didn't work out. So this was the summer of 2008. So I graduated high school in 2007, and my father had built this large multi-million dollar house in Paradise Valley, Arizona, is a spec house, hoping to sell it. It didn't have a predetermined owner. So this house didn't sell. And this was right during the housing collapse during the recession in 2008. So this house, completely empty, no electricity, no running water, just a love seat there in the middle of the house. And I had had a really rough week, a really rough night. And it had been a while since I had talked to God and said some prayers. And it'd been a while since I'd really thought about my life and tried to figure out what a game plan was and where I needed to go from here. So I decided to say a prayer. And it had been a long time, like I said, since I had done that. So it was pretty incredible to me whenever that prayer was answered. So what I said was, "Lord, I don't know what you want me to do with my life, but I need direction and I trust you. And whatever you want me to do, I want you to call my dad at precisely the moment that I wake up in the morning and reveal it through him." And the reason why my rationale behind selecting my dad for that is because he'd been the only person I trusted at the time, and I hadn't talked to him in weeks. So I had felt that if he had called me at the moment I woke up, that it would have been too much to be a coincidence. So I carried on that night and did some other things and curled up in the love seat at probably 3, 4 a.m. and went to bed. And I woke up, and at the time I had a BlackBerry, and I hadn't remembered the prayer when I first woke up. But after about 60 seconds, I jolted down. I'm searching for the phone, and it was under this pillow on the floor. And I had a missed call from precisely the moment that I had woke up, about 60 seconds earlier from when I grabbed the phone. It was a missed call from my father. So I picked it up and I called him back. And before I could really even get going with anything, he offered to take me down to Tucson to meet a gentleman named Chief Master Sergeant James Sanchez, who is now retired, and told me that I should consider pararescue. So that was my answer. Black and white writing on the wall. I knew it was my path to go into pararescue.
Amazing. So when you had that moment, and it's a good job your dad didn't say like a male erotic dancer or something, that would have been awkward.
Fair enough. Thankfully, that wasn't my path.
when he did tell you that was your path, did you immediately lock in? Because obviously we talk about the why, especially when we're going to discuss the selection process later. Did it just immediately ingrain that passion to pursue that career then?
It really did, especially when I met Chief Sanchez. He's something else. He's been on DEVCRU Gold, DEVCRU Blue, DEVCRU Red. He's done stuff with JSOC multiple years of the 24th, obviously, in order to get attached to those teams. He's got a jump mission when he was up at Alaska. I mean, you name it, he's done it. So a guy like that, seeing his humble presence, but just that aura that he gave off, and seeing his eyes, and I can't explain it, but I knew that I wanted to be that guy. So as a son, sometimes you got to see something beyond what your father tells you. You got to get it verified. You take what your dad says with a grain of salt. And at 19 years old, I had gotten past that point, but I still needed to hear it from somebody else what this career was all about. So to hear it from somebody who said, "Hey, you're considering the SEALs. Let me tell you a little bit about what my career was like." It was a game changer, and I knew right then and there. So.
Brilliant. Now, if you wouldn't mind, because like you said, the Seals definitely have more exposure. I think the PJ role is the closest thing to my profession, you know, the rescue and the medical treatment. But can you kind of describe the role of a PJ in the special operations community?
I think the best way to describe a PJ is to contrast them to other medics. If you have a SEAL team that has their own medics and is supplying their own medics, which they do, that is bringing pararescuemen, there's something to be said about that. Pararescuemen are obviously expected to be top tier medics, but the primary role of a pararescuemen is to be an expert in personnel recovery. Personnel recovery may involve setting up a rope system. It may involve being able to survey a landing zone and understanding which patients are a certain priority and being able to coordinate aircraft to come in and pick those patients up, being able to direct a security team, whatever it is. The PJ is a rescue specialist. And when something bad happens, the PJ takes over and is able to direct the forces on the ground and connect them with the air to get that person off the battlefield and keep them alive.
Yeah, and that's what I've said this before. If I was going to choose one of those, now having learned, you know, from all these amazing people I got to interview and really hear firsthand, I think that would be the one that I would align to. And I can just say this, knowing myself, I don't think I would be that courageous when it was, you know, initiating combat. But in our profession, it's a different kind of courage when it's kind of deflected, and now you're in a mode of rescuing someone. That courage comes from a different place, and I think that that's probably where a lot of people that I work alongside can relate, versus law enforcement that are more like, you know, the more you know, the SEALs and the Green Berets that are actually going, you know, into the bullets specifically to initiate combat. So I think that you know, like I said, this particular branch that you were a member of is very close to what the people that I work alongside signed up to do as well, but obviously not, you know, overseas.
Right. And you know, I just want to give a shout out to the entire rescue community, because, you know, it really doesn't come down to who's dodging bullets or not. It really comes down to people that are putting themselves second and putting themselves at extreme risk to rescue somebody, no matter what the cost. And there's a lot of incredible men and women out there in the States and outside of the States that do that every single day. So shout to you guys. Much respect.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, there's so many people doing incredible things every day. Okay, so then I would love to in depth explore the selection process, because I mean, in OA, obviously you're going to be trained in a vast, diverse set of skills, but the setting the bar and eliminating people that aren't reaching that bar is something that I'm very passionate about, and I talk about a lot on this podcast, because it should also apply to police, it should apply to fire. But the special ops, it seems like you guys are very good at maintaining that bar, whereas some of our agencies, that bar starts to get pulled down because of politics and quotas and that kind of thing. So what was your, you know, entry, your initial kind of first week like, and then your journey from there on?
Right. So I'm going to actually go with boot. I'm going to start with boot camp. I'm not going to skip over that, because I had an interesting experience. We were flight 065, and this was in October 28th of 2008 is when we actually started. And this was an experimental group. We had about 70 guys, and all except for two or three who I feel were placed in there purposely. They were security forces guys, or that was their contract that they were shooting for. All but those three were in battlefield airmen contracts, is what they call them. And they still do call them. That will be changing soon. But TACP, CCT, SEER, or Pararescue, or SAU-T. So they were trying to see how they could, or if they could get any data or see any results from compiling all of these guys into the same group. Now, one of the problems that they hadn't addressed at the time was giving us time set aside to train during boot camp. So we would show up to boot camp doing underwater swims and treading water and lifting weights and doing rucking and all of these things. And then all of a sudden we're folding t-shirts all day, marching, memorizing Air Force insignias and the Airman's Creed, which is all very important things to become an airman. But it's taking away from your ability to maintain that level of training as an elite athlete that's required for pararescue or combat control. So what was interesting is that they brought in this Marine Corps MTI to cross train from the Marines to the Air Force. And his name is Carl Little. And I still keep in touch with him. And he is a menacing figure, 6'4", light-skinned African-American guy, hilarious, but extremely intimidating, witty, played mind games, very intense, extremely intimidating man. And this guy would tear our flight up. He would have us doing push-ups in the day room, as he called it, to where there was sweat dripping all over the floor. Now, Marine boot camp, Army boot camp, like, yes, that's typical, but not typical for the Air Force. So it was good exposure for us to get hardened up, as I would call it, before we went to selection. So that was a decent little experience for us to get exposure to somebody that was that intense before we went off to selection. And we had a hard group of men, I will say that. Carl Little hardened us up. So after we got done with boot camp, we went over to Pararescue Indoctrination course, and that started fairly quickly. And one of the things I will share, James, is the difference between Pararescue Indoctrination at the time versus now is that you really got thrown to the wolves at the time. Now, when my father went in, you couldn't even get a PJ contract. You went in open general, and they showed you a video in boot camp, and you went and gave it a shot. When I went through in 2008, okay, you had a PJ contract, but when you went to Indoc, you immediately had probably 30 guys quit on the first or second day in the pool. And they were quitting just on simple 25-meter underwater swims, mass clearing, whatever it was. They had no experience in the water. So they were excellent athletes on land, but when it came to doing things under the water particularly, they weren't experienced in it. So we had guys dropping like flies, 30% of the class gone in the first 2 days, versus now they have what's called the Special Warfare Training Wing. And the Special Warfare Training Wing is several months long, and it prepares these athletes for what they're going to see at their respective selection courses. So they will be doing underwater swims. They'll be learning from Olympic swim coaches. They learn how to clear their mask. They lift weights, they run, they get intro to nutrition. They have all of their biomarkers tracked through a Zephyr monitor. It's pretty incredible what they're doing there at the Special Warfare Training Wing right now to prepare these guys to try to lower that attrition rate that you're seeing in pararescue, which has typically been 90% plus.
Now, has your dad helped you prepare before you entered this journey?
He did. He did. To a point. He took me up in the mountains where I went to high school in Payson, and he ran me up these hills. He would have me jump up on these branches and do pull-ups. He'd stick me in the pool with sweatpants on, sweatshirt on, and make me do underwaters, do things, tasks under the water. It had been a while since he had been in pararescue, but he was able to give me some creative exercises to do to kind of get me in shape for the first 6 weeks. And once that was done, I moved down to Tucson, kind of disconnected myself from the world to focus on training. And I was doing two-a-days for about 7 or 8 weeks until I enlisted.
Right. Okay. So you said you lost 30% in that first couple of days. So that's that's 2 days in. Lead us through the rest of it.
2 days in. Yeah. So 2 days in, we lost 30% of our class. I'd say within probably 2 or 3 weeks, we were down to about 50 guys. 50% of our class was gone. We have what's called extended training day, or hell night, as they want to call it. And what they do is they keep you up all night and you do an extra 2 water confidence sessions. And then instead of getting sleep the next night, they wake you up early. So you get about a 2-hour nap to tease you a little bit, and then they take you straight to the pool. So they really just try to beat on you for a few days to see if they can get anyone to quit. That was usually in week 4. For us, it was about halfway through week 4. And by the time that was done, we had 28 of our original 100. So we had lost 72 guys at that point.
All right, and then what was the next step after that?
Next step after that was to pass evals. You know, I know you're interested in some of the differences between pararescue training and other schools. This is coming from Isaiah Staley, who is a former pararescue man and combat rescue officer that crossed over and became a SEAL officer, went to BUDS. According to Isaiah, One of the biggest differences at Buds is that you don't have evaluations on Monday as you do at Pararescue Indoctrination. And what I mean by that is that every Monday at Indoc, you're getting some type of evaluation that is increasing weekly. So you'll start off at a 1.5 mile run, a 500 meter swim, 25 meter underwaters at a 3 minute interval or something like that, very basic. And each week they'll turn up the heat to where in the last week you'll need to do a 6 mile run at a certain time standard. You'll need to do a 3,000 meter fin swim at a certain time standard, full harassment, buddy breathing, three knot series underwater, et cetera. And they have this detailed checklist of what you have to do. Now, you know it's coming, but if you don't meet those standards, even if you're tough, even if you don't quit, you're getting set back or you're getting eliminated. Versus Buds, you don't have those standards past hell or up into hell week. You're just getting beat on every single day. So that being said, once we got through that extended training day, it was all about getting through those evaluations and surviving. And when we did graduate, we had 15 guys left out of that original 100 who were ready to take on the next year and a half of training.
Wow, yeah, that's a hell of an attrition rate. And what you were saying about preparing, you know, that makes sense. Obviously, there's going to be some people that just when they're put in the, you know, under pressure, they're gonna crack and they're gonna realize they weren't, the right fit. But like you were saying, if there were some people that were great candidates but just hadn't had the opportunity, and you know, really we should all have the opportunity if we know the career we're going into, but could be given some mentorship in their weaknesses, they may have ended up being, you know, 20 or 25 passing if they just had that extra time to prepare.
Agreed. And not only that, they started lowering the standards slightly afterwards as well. They had removed the 50 meter underwater for a time and then they added it. They slowed the runtime down a little bit. There were some things that lessened the attrition rate as far as the standards went. But now, because of this special warfare training wing, you don't see guys dropping like flies on the underwater. So theoretically, you'll hopefully see larger numbers in these career fields in the next couple of years.
Right. Well, just before we talk about the rest of the training, I heard Tim Kennedy talking about this, and I've spoken to a couple other people on the show. The military in general, I've heard people talk about police and fire, especially the special ops, though. The way that we are as a society, the way that we're not growing up, you know, on bikes, on farms, but we're in this very, very gentle, comfortable society that we live in now, with air conditioning and phones and cars and all these other things. Are you seeing in the PJ side a smaller pool to take these candidates from in the first place?
Well, I think that's very well put, James. So we're seeing candidates that are stronger physically, but they don't have the ability to critically problem solve. They don't have the mental resiliency and they don't have the communication skills. And all of that comes from what you mentioned before, typically being on your cell phone, having a softer generation or whatever you want to call it. These guys need to go through somewhat of a mental indoctrination now as physical abilities and the physical requirements for these career fields are much more common knowledge.
Yeah, because I mean, what you're asking these men and women to do, the women in certain fields, is the same thing. That hasn't changed, but our comfort level has. And I'm sitting right now in a house with air conditioning and the lights are on, you know, so none of us are immune to it, but I can see how that would be challenging to prepare people for a career that, you know, is partially involved around suffering.
Absolutely. And whenever you throw that shock factor at guys, you weed them out really quick. So one of the things that I'm interested to see the results with is if these programs that are investing 3 months, that being the Special Warfare Training Group, if these programs are indeed helping these guys or they are crippling them for over-preparing them for what's known or what's unknown. Because I'll say it 1,000 times, when you get on a mission, things generally don't go as planned. Now you have that checklist, you have that mission plan to always go back on whenever you have a lull in the fight or you have a brief moment or a pause, but generally things never go as planned. So it's not wise for these guys to train for the known all the time and know exactly what's coming and be prepped for everything.
Yeah, actually, that reminds me of a post you put up the other day about the tying the knots under the water, and you were showing certain knots and warning people. That doesn't mean that it's going to be the knots for next year.
Right. And I actually just got word that those knots are gone. So
there you go.
Yeah. So you're looking at those knots leaving either now or within the next couple weeks. So
yeah. And I think the lesson from that is learn how to tie all your knots under the water, and that way you're prepared for whatever they throw at you.
Absolutely. Or just look up some knots on your own and get proficient with your hands and get used to doing those types of things. And know that there were many people before you that never learned those knots and never had any prep and made it through just fine. So you got to have faith in the Air Force. You got to have faith in the Army and in the Navy that they're going to teach you what you need to be taught. I think a lot of people are getting a little bit too obsessive about being overprepared.
Yeah.
It's maybe a confidence issue, but eventually you just got to go. You got to go tackle the unknown.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing is, I think we can prepare for certain areas. And I always tell this to future firefighters. I'm like, you can prepare for your written test. You can prepare for your physical entry test because there are parameters. It's a set test. But then, the other areas are out of your control. So just dial up the areas you can control. And then that way, like you said, be ready for the unknown.
Well said.
All right. So then you graduated. So what does the training side now look like as far as, the skills that you need as a PJ?
So the first thing you go to, and, obviously you're still a cone head, as we call it, somebody who doesn't have a beret. You're just a wannabe. You go to combat dive school, and that's actually no longer we actually no longer go to the Army combat dive school in Key West. We go to an Air Force combat dive school, which is in Panama City. It's kind of ironic that the Air Force has their own dive school, but they don't have either a static line jump school or a halo school for pipeline students. That was always puzzling to me. But anyways, you go down there for this course, and it's a heck of a course, incredible instructors, great area to dive on, great academics, good group of men, controllers that have just graduated. That are mixed with all of these PJ candidates that just graduated in docs. So combat dive school was great. Have some fun stories from that. Great memories. Came away feeling pretty confident in the water.
Brilliant. And then what about the trauma medicine side? Because that's obviously something that parallels, here as well. What's your medical training like over that year and a half?
Right. So we went to jump school and survival school and halo school. And then after that, had to hack EMT basic and EMT paramedic. Now we do those on the civilian. So we hire a civilian contracted company through the University of New Mexico at the time. And they were called the University of New Mexico EMS Academy, I believe. And the advantage of going through these guys is that we walked away from this course with the civilian recognized EMT paramedic license. The problem with that is that we had to go over ambulance-based medicine and do a lot of things such as scene safety that we knew were not going to be applicable per se on a mission. So that's just something that you had to deal with, maybe develop a couple trainingisms, as I like to call them. But besides that, it's an absolute positive thing that you get your EMT paramedic certification. After that, you go off and do clinicals, which was an incredible experience for me, getting to do ride-alongs with Station 8 Engine 8 out in Tucson, and getting to work in the ER, doing stuff in the OR with Dr. Nogami, being able to do 12 intubations during clinicals as a student. By the time I got to Afghanistan, that's exactly what I drew from, was those experiences. So clinicals was incredible. After clinicals, we got our EMT paramedic national registry test. I struggled with that, actually. I had to rehack it a few times, man. It was the only time where I got set back in my PJ training was with that EMT paramedic test.
Yeah, there's some funky questions on those tests, and because it's national registry, they're drawing from that diverse spectrum of meds too. The local protocols are normally a lot narrower.
Yes, and I had very minimal study skills at the time, and I would second guess myself. The answers were always pretty tricky, and that test being a test where you have to pass all sections, and if you fail one, you fail the whole thing. That was a struggle. So finally took care of business and got that certification, and then went off to the apprentice course. Now, the pararescue apprentice course is 6 months, and that's where they take your medical skills and turn them into operational medical skills. you do your water stuff, your water jumps, all of your helo stuff in the water at that point. You learn tactics, land navigation as a team, all of that good stuff. Now, my father actually started my pararescue apprentice course with me. He actually fast-tracked through this paramedic course. So he re-enlisted, okay, into the Air Force when I was in the pipeline to be a PJ. And so he re-enlisted through the unit I was at, the 306 Rescue Squadron out of Tucson. And Chief Sanchez worked my father's paperwork to where he went up to this paramedic course up in Boise, Idaho, with this gentleman named Tom Bosman. And that's where my dad actually met his current wife, was up in Boise, Idaho. Shout out to Dad and Janny. He passed the course, took his national registry, started the apprentice course with me, and he found out 2 weeks into the apprentice course that he failed national registry, like son, like father. and he had to go rehack it, and he took care of business, and he ended up starting in the class behind me. But yeah, so I know you're probably going to ask this question, so I'll probably beat you to the punch here, James. My father, when he reenlisted, he did not have to go through the entire PJ pipeline. He only had to go through the paramedic course, because when they went through back in the late 80s, there was no EMT paramedic or even EMT intermediate really for them to get at the time. So he had to hack that, and then he had to do the apprentice course. So unfortunately, we did not graduate together. But when I graduated, he gave me his beret and put it on my head. And when he graduated, I gave him my beret and put it on his head. And it was a pretty incredible moment, both of them.
Wow. So what made him want to jump back in again?
I would say a combination of the recession and wanting to make sure he had my back, make sure I stayed out of trouble.
That's brilliant. And so then after that, was he full-time or was he reserve?
So we were both at a reserve unit, but we were full-time at that reserve unit.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So you did the civilian paramedic. So now I'm intrigued. Once you went on to the military side, what was the difference in the way you were trained? And were there any interventions that we weren't doing at the time in the civilian paramedic?
Oh, absolutely. It was night and day. You took all your gear out of the pack. You learned all kinds of tricks on how to stow your gear to make it more quickly accessible. We started using all types of different gear that we hadn't been exposed to in the civilian course, such as different types of quick clot, more aggressive tourniquets, adding new skills such as antibiotics, rapid sequence intubation, doing chest tubes, more invasive procedures that are not in the scope of practice for a civilian paramedic.
Yeah, and that's something I think that I can foresee hopefully one day our medic side will progress, because you become a paramedic and then on paper, I'm not talking about training and redoing skills, but on paper, we hit that ceiling. And there's so many more things that we could do. And it is, you know, a huge amount that we do, but I think that by adding more education, maybe even making a higher level, like an advanced paramedic, would only help further our skills out there on the street and also shorten the gap. If you've got this gap between what you guys are doing and what we're doing on the street, trauma is trauma at the end of the day. So we should, I believe, you know, be brought up to the military level as well.
I think I agree with you. Now to put a flip side to that would be the skills that you learn essentially are dictated by how long you're going to be out in the field and how long your transport time is going to be. So if you have, per se, medics that are going to be operating in a city and they're not going to be dealing with extended transport times, it wouldn't be that great of an investment to expect your medics to learn some of these more invasive procedures that involve postponing death for a much longer time when they're not going to be dealing with those transport times. And those procedures may take a lot more time to upkeep as far as currency goes. Would you agree with that or disagree with that to some extent?
No, I would absolutely agree with that. Yeah, if you're in an urban department, and this happens even now, I've spent most of my career in urban, but there are certainly county departments where their transport time might be 1-2 hours. So that's definitely a different, more of a need then for those more advanced procedures, even things like RSI. Whereas if I'm 2 minutes from a hospital, I'm probably just going to ventilate and then put them on a nice clean ER table before we do that.
Right, right. So whenever you see more, you see medics that are more out in rural areas and out in the country that can't have more inclined personnel that have more intervention skill, maybe you want to get those medics a little better equipped than some of those medics that are dealing with shorter transport times in the city.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, then. So let's just go over to your deployment then. I guess the first question is, you know, what was your experience from being back in America, going through all this great training, but now finding yourself in Afghanistan? What was that first transition like for you?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was great. It was everything that I wanted to do. I volunteered to go over there. There were guys who actually got turned down because so many of us were volunteering for that deployment. So I compare it to practicing for football. If you practice all week for a football game and then you don't get to play in the game, it doesn't really make much sense. So as a PJ, you practice, you practice, you practice, and you want to go play. And obviously it's not a game, it's life, but we train and train and train for years. And I was jumping at the bit to go over there. So was very excited to have that opportunity to be trusted to go save lives that others may live in Afghanistan. Unfortunately for me, when I first got there, I was on a jump rotation and we didn't get any jump missions as most guys don't when they go over there. So I did a lot of waiting for my first month in Afghanistan, man.
Right. And then what were some of the things, I mean, you don't have to go into specifics, I'm sure it's, you're not able to talk about that much, but what were some of the types of rescues that you did while you were over there?
Right. So once I got over on what we would call the rotary rotation, we had established a new team over there and a new tasking, and we called it the Guardian Angel Tactical Response Team. And the idea of this team was to be able to embed to other special operations forces and to not be specifically attached to an HH-60 PAVHOK platform. There were other aircraft over at Bastion Airfield that would be able to open up our ability to do different mission platforms, such as the CV-22s. So we had a tasking as the Guardian Angel Tactical Response Team. Typically, the tasking for that would be known as Fever, and that would be a fixed-wing tasking where you would be doing halo jumps or fixed-wing jumps out of a C-130. So once we got over to the rotary tasking, as we called it, we were doing up to three missions a day, anything from CASAVAC to personnel recovery. We would get called out quite a bit. Now, these missions would be anything from a mass casualty, where we would be down there triaging, to picking up somebody at a FOB, to doing a rescue under gunfire with armed escorts, Apaches, H-64s, AH-1s, you name it. It's pretty hot down there in the Nadi Ali area. We called it the green zone. So anytime that you got a mission and you recognize those coordinates that are down by the Nadi Ali River where they're fielding all the poppy and the opium, you knew that it was going to get interesting.
Yeah. Now you hear people talking about that, about the opium fields over there. There's a lot of seemingly miscommunication about that. Those opium fields, they're not destined to come overseas to us, are they?
No, they're not. And that was one of the primary reasons why we were there. And just about every mission that we were on that involve any type of gunfire or any type of high-risk mission, we were landing in and around an opium field.
Right. So what is, you know, what, why are they growing so much opium there? And is the country not trying to eliminate that?
You know, that's something that I couldn't really touch on, James. I apologize. My best guess would be is that you have, at this point, you have fields and fields of it. And unless you burn it down or cut it down, it's not just going to stop growing. So who's going to make use of it? That's the big question to me.
Gotcha. All right, we'll move on. So one notable story that I saw was in one of the publications that I read about you was a little 9-year-old Afghani boy. Would you be able to explain that story?
Yeah, James, I don't mind talking about that mission. This boy, actually, we got called out to pick him up, and he had got caught in some crossfire, and we picked him up from what we call a POI, and that's a point of injury. So sometimes we would pick up our patients on a FOB. They would already be packaged up. It would be somewhat of a secure area, and we'd have an LZ that was walled in and somewhat concrete or a solid floor, hard floor, versus a POI, we would land right where the action was or a safe area that was somewhat close. So we landed on a POI, and I don't remember if it was a British recon team I believe it was a team of Brits. They ran this Afghani boy onto the helicopter, and he had been shot several times with AK fire. And I just remember our protocol being, if they had any wounds that were at the belly button or above, and their O2 sats were going down, or they were cyanotic, struggling for air, you need to consider decompressing their chest because they probably had some type of thoracic cavity protrusion and could be developing a tension pneumothorax. So I just remember that we had different responsibilities. There were three PJs on the aircraft, and one PJ would typically be responsible for the airway. And this is assuming we only had one patient. Sometimes we would have three, four, but in this particular case, it was just the 9-year-old. So we had one PJ that was working the airway. And so working the airway would require administering any drugs that needed to be done through the airway, oxygen, any airway adjuncts, advanced or simple, et cetera. We also had a PJ that was going to be working circulation, so getting any type of IV access, et cetera. The other PJ was responsible for maintaining the vital signs, keeping overall situational awareness, basically the team leader. So my responsibility at this time was to establish access. He didn't have any veins presenting. So the first thing I did was go for a humeral head interosseous infusion. And we had a pediatric humeral head IO. I know so many people say they think tibia as far as pediatric IOs go, but our protocol was humeral head. So went to the humeral head and we started getting this whole packed red blood cell line ready. So the protocol that we had over there was to fill a Y tubing is what we called it. We'd have one line with saline, one line with blood, and then we'd have this Y tubing and we'd have it hooked up to a pressure infuser and an inflow warmer so that we were actually giving these guys warm blood. If you didn't have the saline infused with it, it would get clogged up in the line, and it already got clogged up enough with the saline. So we had to pump it in with a big syringe. We'd suck it out, use a three-way stop cock, and then open up the three-way stop valve and then push it in. So anyways, we finally got access on this boy, and his O2 sats were going down quite a bit. They had gone down all the way to 82. So at this point, I knew that I had to decompress his chest because our protocol clearly stated that anything above the belly button was going to get a chest decompression, and his sats were going down. We had him on oxygen. There was no choice. Unfortunately, we didn't have a chest dart for pediatrics. So I had to pull out this big old North American Rescue chest dart for an adult that was meant to go through multiple layers of clothes. And I just remember my hands shaking so much as I was going for that landmark. And it had been the first time my hands had ever shook like that before. So I steadied my hands as I got the tip of the needle in between his second and third intercostal space. And I entered it about halfway. And I remember right when I put that needle in, his eyes opened up and they were huge. And as that happened, his sats started going back up. And I thought that that had actually been the intervention that had saved his life. But as most medical operations are, it's a team effort, and it ended up being the blood that saved his life. And he actually had no thoracic protrusion. But going back in the present, we dropped this guy off at Bastion Hospital, which was a level one trauma center. So they should be able to take care of anything like that. Let me rewind. We dropped him off at an Afghani hospital first because they wanted to take care of their own. And it was some program where they wanted to start transitioning from having us take care of all of their people and have them start taking care of their people at their hospitals that had a lot of American workers there and people consulting with them, American medical gear, et cetera. So this was called Lashkar Gah Hospital that we took the boy to, dropped him off, went back to base. We just got our medical gear reconstituted, everything ready to go, and we get another 9-line drop. So we start sprinting out to the helicopters, getting all of our gear back on, and our intel guys come out with the 9-lines, handing us the few pieces of information that we have at the time. What we see on there is that it's a 9-year-old boy and that we're picking him up from coordinates that are right at Lashkar Gah Hospital. So we know right away it's the same boy. And I mean, this had to have been less than 30 minutes after we dropped him off. So we spun up and we picked him up again. And obviously we had darted him and all of these things. Well, they didn't know what to do. And so we had a 12-minute transport time, and all the gear that we had put on him before, it was all mangled, and they had put new gear on him, and they didn't know how to write good English on their patient treatment card. So it was quite a gaggle. So we did what we could for the 12-13-minute transport time. We got him to the hospital, and I didn't think he was going to make it, but I found out later that they ended up taking out one of his organs. I want to say it was his spleen, but don't quote me on that. And the boy lived. So it was a pretty incredible mission. It's what inspired me to go to school to be a doctor.
That's amazing. And that's, I've always said in our profession, if you just change one life, you know, that you're going to see some of your colleagues are going to have all the miraculous saves, they're going to be all the papers and everything. But if you change just one life in your career, everything else is a bonus.
Right. And you know, I must admit that it was probably because he was a young boy that made it extra impactful, because there were many missions that had similar trauma on it. But just something about him being young and having a chance to live that life out was special to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I've had, again, several military men and women on here talking about this as well. The misconception, you know, that we are fed sometimes through news agencies is, you know, everyone in Iraq is our enemy, everyone in Afghanistan is our enemy. But then I've had obviously soldiers that were there on the ground say, well, no, you just, while we're going through this battle zone, there's men fixing the car, women making dinner, the kids kicking around a football. Did you see that same kind of scenario when you were in here, that these poor men and women were just living in a battle zone?
I did. And I think it's really important for people to understand that this is a war on terror. It's not a war on Afghanistan. And these people want to be free. But the problem is when we leave, and whether it be immediately or long term, the Taliban comes in. So what do they do?
Yeah, exactly. Rock in a hard place. And it's so heartbreaking. I wish we could figure out an effective way to just stamp them out. But I mean, coming from England and seeing the terrorism from the IRA years ago, it's, you know, how do you eliminate a group of people that look exactly the same as the innocents?
I agree. And if we don't do it, I don't know who is. And oftentimes when, you know, coming from a university like University of Arizona, when people have a debate with me on the war effort, I often bring it up to them, and I don't get offensive and I don't get condescending. I just like to ask questions. And generally the question that I ask is, what would you do if there was no military? And what do you think terrorism would do? And what would you do if terrorism made its way to the United States? And that's really the big question for me is, if we didn't fight terrorism, how close would they get to this country's borders?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they already have. They've crossed it many, many times. So
They have.
All right. So then, you had, you know, your active duty time. What was the reason that you decided to transition out of the military?
I had an opportunity to play football at the U of A. I was going to school for medicine. And I met my wife, Jessica, and the combination of the three with my father transitioning out of the unit, it made sense for me to go that route. Being in the reserves, I was active duty at the reserve unit, being on a long-term tour. So I was able to switch off to a reserve status to finish up my last 2 years. And so being in a position where I was playing football at the U of A and had walked on the team, it was very challenging to stay up with my pararescue duties. So when my 6 years was up, I decided to continue to pursue medicine and pursue my wife and pursue football.
Right. And when you say football, so before when we started the conversation, your sport was baseball. How how did you find yourself playing football for the university?
Football was always my love. I just accepted that I wasn't good enough at it in high school to get a scholarship. And when you come from a town like where I come from in Payson, Arizona, often that's the only way out. So I love baseball, don't get me wrong, but that was my ticket. And it did get me out of Payson. Football was always my greater love. It's an intense game. It's action packed. There's nothing like football. So when I found myself a little heavier, a little stronger, a little faster at 25 years old, I decided to give it a shot.
That's brilliant. Now, when you came out of the military, and this is something that we talk about quite a lot on this show, you had spent, you know, all that time out there amongst the trauma, amongst seeing, you know, Americans die, seeing Afghanis die. Was there any problem transitioning out as far as the mental side?
I think the hardest transition was slowing the tempo down and going from a state of vigilance and going from a constant purpose and knowing that everything you do is everything that you've trained for and that you're right where you need to be, to all of a sudden coming back to the States and everything slows down and everything's different. So for me, that was the hardest part, was transitioning to a completely different tempo and lifestyle.
Yeah. And then did you notice as well, being part of that cohesive team as a PJ, losing that? Because that's what a lot of people find, whether they retire from the fire service or, you know, whatever it is, when they lose that tribe, that group that they were so ingrained in, part of that is traumatic as well.
Well, you know, I definitely lost the tribe as far as an operational perspective, but one of the greatest parts of this brotherhood and one of the greatest parts of technology is that you can keep in touch with these guys like you've never missed a beat. And I have a couple brothers that I talk to literally daily. I cannot think of another career, another team, where you have a brotherhood like Pararescue, a group of men that have dedicated their lives to putting themselves in the face of danger for other people and the type of personality that attracts. So, got a few guys, like I said, that I love and I've kept in touch with since boot camp. So yeah, you know, the career's gone, operations is gone, but my brothers are still close and the tribe is still here.
I love it. That's the first person that's actually said that, and it makes obviously a lot of sense. And we're doing an interview over Skype right now, but that technology is there to stay in touch with that tribe. And it's just up to you guys all making the effort to keeping in contact.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. All right. Well, another thing, so you're playing football now. I noticed that you did some research in concussion. Now, obviously, that's an interesting topic, not only in the football arena, but also military and first responder. So what does your research involve regarding that topic?
The research involved a competition called the NCAA/Department of Defense Mind Matters Challenge. And the winners of these competitions were given $180,000 in grant money to fund their educational tool. And what the competition asked for is to develop some type of educational tool that will change the culture of college football players to start reporting their concussions. Now, one would think, okay, why is it problematic to report a concussion when you get hit and you go unconscious? Well, that is what we call a grade 3 concussion. You have being 3 common grades of concussion. You have a grade 1, which is where you would say getting your bell rung for the football players out there. Okay, maybe you get a little lightheaded or some tingles, but nothing serious, no symptoms. You're back in the fight in a few seconds. Versus a grade 2 concussion, you don't go unconscious, but you have some symptoms. Maybe you're loopy, you got double vision, you don't know what's going on, you're dizzy, you have a speck in your eye, color vision impairment, whatever it is, slowed reaction time. Those are all things that you'll see common with a grade 2 concussion, especially in football, where you see 40 different common symptoms, but 5 typically being the most common. So what we decided to do was develop this virtual reality phone app. And Google Cardboard has this $4, it was what it costs in bulk, this little platform where you fold it up and you insert the slots and you put your phone in the back of it. It has this little slot for your phone. You hold it up to your face and now you're in virtual reality. So what our app entailed was we took Scooby Wright, who was my teammate at the time, and he was a 2014 Defensive Player of the Year. He was in the Heisman race at the time. We took myself and Scooby Wright and we got transformed into virtual reality. And then we took a drone before drones were cool and mainstream and into Arizona Stadium and transformed it into virtual reality. And then we created software and an algorithm and a coach and a scenario in which you would catch punts in virtual reality, real time, as if you were really in Arizona Stadium, you were immersed in that environment. You catch punts. You had one button here with Google Cardboard. So you have to look up when they kick the ball, and then you would have to time the ball with that one button and catch it. And when you caught it, Scooby would hit you and you would get 1 of 5 common concussion symptoms. Now, the purpose of that would be that if these athletes, 50% of them is what our data showed, have never had a concussion coming into college football. So if you're going to hound them and say that you expect them to report a grade two, okay, when they're in the fight and they have adrenaline going and they have that warrior mentality, take themselves out of the game, remove themselves from the fight when they have never had those symptoms before, there's no way they're going to be able to do it. We teamed up with a behavioral psychologist, a neuroscientist, et cetera, to be able to validate this data and do studies and whatnot. And what we came up with is that in order to get these players to report their concussion under stress and do what's right medically, what's right for their health and longevity, they had to be educated, whether it be VR, whether it be flyers hanging up around, whether it be talked to by their staff or a combination of all of them, they had to be educated. Because the education I got for concussions when I got to the university was a 10-minute video that I watched upon getting my uniform, getting a new locker room, getting sized up. I mean, there was probably 6 hours worth of things I did that day. I don't even remember what was on the video. So the point is that it wasn't prioritized. We made it into a culture. We put a hashtag on it and it had a logo and a lot of different things, and we won the contest. So that was called Brain Gains, if you ever wanted to look it up. And the gentleman that I did that with was Ricardo Valerdi, the mastermind behind it.
Brilliant. Now, just to understand that, so once they've been hit with a certain concussion type, now their ability to catch the ball would go down and they'd kind of experience these symptoms?
Right. Apologies for leaving that out. So whenever you get one of these concussions, the idea is they stay in the game. So even though the correct answer would be to remove themselves from the game, we force them to stay in the game for the sake of the video game, and they continue to catch punts with one of the five symptoms. Because from what we've shown, players under stress and under adrenaline, when they're in the heat of the moment, they don't really care about their physical health. They're not really concerned with the future. But if you show them that they could let their teammates down with their performance, they will remove themselves from the fight. They care more about the man next to them than the man themselves, or than themselves.
That seems like an amazing innovation, because like you said, how many people really look at posters or even videos, you know? But when you're experiencing it and it's that tactile feedback, then that's really going to resonate with them much, much deeper than a piece of paper.
Right. Right. And it did. So we saw good results with it, and the NCAA took it, and we didn't really hear from them beyond that, as none of the other teams did.
Right. Huh. Okay.
That's how it goes.
All right. Well, I like the story up to that last bit.
Yeah.
Okay. So then I guess the last thing I really want to talk about before we do some wrap-up questions is you are part of a company, SOCOM Athletes. So I'd love to hear about what you're doing for the future special operations and special forces members.
Yeah, sure, James. Where it started was as a reservist PJ. Like I said, full-time at that reserve unit for 4 years. But as a reservist PJ, we kind of do in-house recruiting, and we host our own tryouts. And these tryouts are pretty strenuous. They involve much higher standards than your typical entry test would be, usually 3 and 4 times harder than those standards. And then a suit and tie interview afterwards, somewhat of a round table type process where guys kind of vote whether or not they think somebody should be on the team. It's a highly selective process. So we got used to contacting guys that were interested in becoming a PJ at the 306 and helping facilitate their process, training with them, plugging them in with recruiters, et cetera. It was just something that we did voluntarily because we cared. So I kind of took it to the next level, and I trained a lot of my friends and people that wanted to do it. I just did it voluntarily for years, built a lot of connections and learned a lot from that. As I got on a platform playing football at the U of A, the most common questions and emails and whatnot that I received from people was advice on training for special operations. So my senior year of college, I realized that I was going to need to get work, or I was going to need to start a company or something. So I realized that what I could be essentially the best at and the most needed at the time was fulfilling these guys' needs on advice for preparing for SOF and taking that to the next level and beyond. So decided to incorporate SOCOM Athlete.
First client was Randy Johnson's son, actually, who wanted to go into SWAT. Randy Johnson is a Hall of Fame 6'10" left-handed pitcher that retired from the Arizona Diamondbacks. So that was a great start. And from there, we ended up becoming a somewhat of a social media online community that is now the nation's number one resource for soft prep, whether it be guys coming on there looking for advice or us grouping guys up into group chats in their city, traveling to those cities and training them, doing assessment tests and being able to rank them and score them, establishing personal relationships with them, getting them in touch with operators that can help them decide which career field is best for them, answering recruiter questions, getting them plugged in with the right recruiter, helping them with medical questions, you name it, workout programs. We're trying to be the one-stop shop for everything that a candidate needs to be successful from the moment that they're interested to the moment they enlist.
Excellent. So again, helping with that candidate retention as well.
Yes, sir.
Fantastic. Yes, sir.
But not just that, but also the growth of these men and their integrity and their growth as men and leaders and teammates. And that's something that we really focus on, James, at these events, is selflessness and being able to communicate, being able to think under pressure, solve skills. A lot of the things that we talked about earlier that these generations are lacking.
Right. And actually, just reminded me, one more thing I want to talk about before we do the wrap-up questions.
Yes, sir.
Transitioning from the military into the civilian world again, you know, I've heard varying things as far as being prepared for it. What was your experience like?
Well, transitioning to the civilian world is, it's very challenging if you don't have something to replace or supplement what you had before. So I was blessed to have football, and that was an excellent transition. Having my wife there with me by my side the whole time, having something to work on with school, staying busy is what helped me. The transition was challenging, but being able to be a part of a new tribe, obviously you can't compare a Division I football team to a brotherhood like Pararescue, but it was a brotherhood and it was a mission to work towards. So the transition was somewhat smooth, but you know, as with any combat veteran, there are challenges.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. So one of the first questions I like to ask to wrap up, is there a book that you love to recommend to people? It can be about what we talked about today or something completely different.
Yeah. I like the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes. If anyone ever has, if anyone, you guys out there like a good read in the Bible, as far as a good academic read, I really recommend The Sports Gene. It is a book, a non-biased written, objective-based book with some brilliant research that really changed the way I thought about athletes. If I am blessed with a son someday or a kid someday, it's changed the way that I've thought about how I try to influence them on what to pursue in athletics. There's some incredible research there. So I recommend it to anybody who wants to dive in and learn in that regards, whether it be DNA in athletics or tracing Usain Bolt's genetics all the way back to a group of runaway slaves in Jamaica that fought for their freedom for the Brits and actually won through a treaty. Pretty incredible stories that are all linked to genetics.
Brilliant. All right. So the same question, a movie and or a documentary that you love?
A documentary. I would say check out Rescue Warriors for some of you guys that are interested in pararescue. It's old. It's a National Geographic documentary, but check it out. Movie. Are we talking like a Hollywood flick?
Anything you want.
Oh, you guys got to go out and watch the Princess Bride one more time. Great movie for the soul.
It is. That's a classic. All right. So
then, well, James, thanks a lot for having me on, man.
Oh, no problem. A couple more and then make sure that we talk about where we can find you and SOCOM Athlete. Is there a person that you would love to recommend to come on this podcast to talk to the first responders and military of the world?
You know, I have dudes who I don't want to name drop them because they're still operating, but they're going to be getting out soon. A guy that I could recommend. Yeah, I got you, dude. His name is Chris Thomas, and he is an instructor at the Special Warfare Training Wing that I mentioned to you earlier. And he also started a business called Valor Med. And Chris is doing some pretty incredible things with Valor Med. He can touch more on that. Essentially, Chris is traveling around to different school districts, and he has a curriculum and some medical gear to equip the schools with in case of a mass shooting or some type of emergency response. So many are concerned on guns and gun safety and putting more security at schools and being able to equip our teachers with good protocols and good SOPs for when something happens like that has been overlooked. So Chris is really filling that gap and has actually landed a couple contracts. So I'm really proud of what he's doing.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you for that. The very last one then before we talk about finding you, what do you do to decompress when you're not playing football or doing podcasts?
Yeah, two things. One of them is being able to have some alone time. Prayer and pondering and meditation are all somewhat different. And I think it's important to have all three. In fact, it is important to have all three. And then the second would be being able to get some type of exercise. With the amount I work right now, I'll catch myself only getting to the gym a couple times a week. So I'll obviously be at the gym or working out my candidates, but that's work. I often don't have the time to be able to get in work myself because I have to watch them and correct them. So it's very important to get into the gym. It keeps re-equilibrium going, especially for somebody who has had that their entire life. You know, don't skip out on that. Get up a little extra early if you have to.
Absolutely. And that's a good thing. If you were a certain level of fitness, it's easier to maintain it than if you lose it.
Absolutely.
All right. So the last final thing then, where can people find SoCalm Athlete and then how can they reach out to you?
Yeah, we're on www.socalmathlete.com and you can follow us on Instagram at SoCalm Athlete.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. It's been a fantastic interview and hearing your journey from, you know, wanting to be a pro baseball player to PJ going through the pipeline with your dad and then coming out as a you know, future surgeon and football player has been quite a unique story. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to our audience.
Well, James, I really appreciate you and everything you've done for others to save lives in your life. Thanks a lot for having me on and for spreading awareness. God bless you.